tuned in to the Community Cats Podcast. Ready? Let's go.
Welcome to the Community Cats Podcast. I'm your host, Stacey LeBaron. I've been involved helping homeless cats for over 30 years with the Merrimack River Feline Rescue Society. The goal of this podcast is to expose you to amazing people who are improving the lives of cats. I hope these interviews will help you learn how you can turn your passion for cats into action. And today, we're speaking with Stephen Quant. Stephen is the founder of Stephen Quant Feline Behavior Associates and is a feline training and behavior specialist certified through the Animal Behavior Institute and a recent author with the publication of his first children's book, Happy Comes Home, available on Amazon. He is a professional feline behavior specialist with over 20 years of experience working with cats in private consultations, animal shelters, and in the field. A background of nationwide rescue work with the ASPCA greatly enriched his empathy with communities of cat lovers in need of help. In 2019, he participated in a spay-neuter and research campaign to assist the animals that live in the exclusion zone around the Chernobyl nuclear power plant, many of whom have descended from the pets left behind after the accident in 1986. His current work with the Animal Care Centers of New York City advances that compassionate connection, and we can find out more at catbehaviorhelp.com. Stephen, I'd like to welcome you to the show.
Thank you so much, Stacey. It is such a pleasure to be here today.
Now, before we dive into all of the work that you've done over the last 20 years, please tell our listeners, how'd you become so passionate about cats?
So, you know, when I was a child, I was a dog person. And there's some different benchmarks that helped me discover the beauty of cats. But there was a particular event. I was volunteering at the time for the ASPCA, and I was asked to go out to the site of the Joplin tornado in 2011. Where it was a terrible tornado, one of the worst in modern history in the US. Hundreds of people died. We had 1,200 cats and dogs in our care. And within a week, I was put in charge of the cat shelter. We went from 100 to 400 cats. It's like battlefield commission. You know, the officers get knocked down and they have to promote somebody. So I got promoted. And I met a cat that I named Petunia. She was so terrified that she would not come out of her box, a feral den inside her crate at all for any reason. And I just, in part of my daily work, I would go and speak to her several times a day. And within a number of days, she came out and she blossomed into the friendliest cat you can imagine. And I learned at that moment, relatively late in life, what it's like to relieve suffering in another creature. And as I'm sure you know, it changes you. And it changed me forever. And that literally that day was the day, I didn't know it at the time, but that was the day my life started to shift from a former career and doing volunteer work for cats to shifting into professional animal welfare. So even though there were plenty of times when I was loving cats before that day stood out as a life-changing moment for me.
I think we all have these aha moments that we're just like, oh, I'm seeing this and I either want to encourage more of this to happen, more connections with the animals or cats that we have. We create these bonds or we try something new. We do something new and it works and it's great. And let's share this with others so that they can do more. I've had times where I've seen dumpsters full of kittens. And it's a vision I never want to see again. And I don't want anyone else to have to see, you know, kittens living out of a dumpster with broken bottles, beer bottles all around. I'm the person who, and you can appreciate this, I was at a feline behavior conference and there was this picture of this kitten up on the screen and a person holding the kitten. And they're asking everyone in the room, what does this picture tell you? And I was the only one in the room said, this kitten never should have been born in the first place, right? And so, you know, everybody was like, let's be reactive. Let's help that kitten. Let's embrace that kitten. And I tend to think a little bit upstream about how did this kitten get here in the first place? And what's the story behind the kitten? But as a feline behaviorist and working with folks, with their cats and with organizations, you're really on the front lines. You're in that reactionary mode of here we are. This is the challenge we're faced with. This is the cat we're faced with. What are we going to do? So, you know, Stephen, what have you learned being on the feline behavior front lines? What's that journey been like for you?
Well, it's a great question, and it's a complicated, there's a lot of ways I could go with it. But, you know, one thing that I've learned is how important it is to be compassionate with people. They contact me when they're in a panic. They contact me when they say, we're at our wit's end and we don't know what to do. And there are, and I don't want to, you know, cast stones, but there are too many people who are judgmental about how we take care of and find homes for and care for our animals, when at these critical junctures in someone's life, they need someone who's going to talk to them compassionately and from a loving point of view, who's not being judgmental about, you know, you should do this and you should do that. And damn it, damn you for even thinking about doing this thing. When we're trying, you know, people are trying the best they can, and we have to bring them the tools to make things better when they don't necessarily have all those tools. So part of my answer to you is to bring compassion and understanding to people.
Yeah. And I love the fact that you also reference tools. It's not just empathy and understanding. That's part of it. But then there's also, let me share my experience with you. Let me share the things that I have used to make life better for the cats in my household, the cats in the community. We talk about feline enrichment and we think about it as an indoor only situation. And I actually feel like indoor outdoor cats, I feel like outdoor only cats, I feel like there's feline enrichment opportunities at all levels of being with a cat in some way, shape, or form. Cats play outdoors just as much as they play indoors, and they hunt indoors just as much as they hunt outdoors. And so I think trying to have feline behavior as an all cat topic is really fascinating, because I do think we think of it more as like, oh, well, we need it for apartment cats, or we need it for this. So tell me more about the work that you do. What are the clients like that you work with?
Sure. And I can tell you what some of the most common behavior problems people contact me about. But one other thing I talk to clients about is outdoor cats don't have behavior problems. They just have behavior. It's when we bring them indoors and we limit, for some cats, obviously there are many cats who are very happy inside, but for some cats, we're limiting what they have evolved to do in terms of predation and activity and obtaining resources. And I like to talk about bringing the outside in, bringing the forest and the field into your home to give your cats problem-solving activities so you aren't the victim of what I call drive-by ankle biting. Right, is just an example. And helping cats engage in normal behaviors in a normal way is super important. And so part of the tools that we talk, I say to folks all the time, I have a webinar I give regularly, and I say to folks, don't just try and stop a behavior. That's counterproductive. We need to know why the cat is engaging this behavior so we can address what this cat needs. The cat needs something. If they're running around, jumping on all your counters and waking you up at 3 a.m, I promise you this cat needs something that they're not getting. And if we can figure out a way to give it to them that doesn't drive us crazy, right? That's the kind of negotiated solution. Then they're happy. And guess what? If they're happy, we're happy too. That's the goal, right? Is to help our cats who are, they're not pack animals in a certain sense. I don't want to make a huge generality there, but between certain groups of animals, they're not in that same category. Although interestingly, there are only 2 species of cats in the world, and there are approximately 42, depends who you talk to, species of cats. Only 2 actually live in groups when the conditions allow this, and that's our cats and lions. And here's a really interesting kind of parallel idea. And I know I'm on a tangent, but I'll get back to it. There are also only 2 species of cats that raise their tail as a greeting. Guess what? Lions and our cats. And, you know, they needed to be able to signal, hey, I'm going to raise my peace flag and say I'm okay, because they do live in groups, unlike the other species, which are really solitary. But again, my hope is to help people figure out how the little lion in their home needs to be given the things that they need in order to live a fully satisfying, meaningful life.
So you mentioned earlier, you said, I'll share with you what are sort of my top three issues that I end up dealing with my clients. I will guess one of them is probably starts with the letter L, but I will let you go on that one. I do cat trivia at a lot of my events, and I would have to say lift the lid is one of the things that an answer to one of my cat trivia questions. So I will let you guess what that's all about.
Yeah, should we call it the L word? So that's problem number two. Litter box behavior is the number two problem. And again, this isn't necessarily representative of all the problems out there, but it's what causes people to come to me and say they want a professional consultation. There are other things that may be going on that people can live with, or they can go to a website and get enough information. So number one above even litter box is cat on cat aggression, or cat aggression generally. When there are two cats that are having a really tough time with each other, or with even more painfully with the human, which is a really specialized topic, we could talk about it a little bit. It's so heartbreaking when the cat that loves you and that you love becomes inexplicably aggressive towards the people in the home. It's heart-wrenching. But aggression is number one, and litter box is number two. And literally everything else becomes a very small percentage of the total. And they become anything from socialization issues or new kitten issues, sometimes destructive behavior, separation anxiety. But litter box and aggression are number one and number two.
Yeah, I had the honor of owning a very aggressive cat that wasn't aggressive to people, but was aggressive to other cats. I mean, you were talking about how most of the behavior issues happened within the house. Now, he was a community cat, unneutered, and he sprayed basically the periphery of my house. And so then my indoor cats, of course, went crazy. And I had my cats at that point in time were indoor, outdoor. So they would meet outside. He would fight with them. He would pee all over them while they were fighting. And then I was like, I found out he really wasn't owned. I got him neutered and I was trying to acclimate him in the house. And a lot of times I did get to the point where I was able to have primarily peace in the house. And it was a lot of work. I did, you know, the food started on the opposite side of the house with the cats, you know, and it marched its way in to where they were somewhat. And I did a lot of play therapy with them, with the cat dancer toy and that kind of stuff. But I do think my original house cats never forgave me for letting him in the house. But it, you know, he was a cat that had been living under a bush for years and had the cauliflower ears and all of that stuff. And he was a marshmallow to my kids, which is so funny. It's hysterical that you see this violent cat on cat, but yet the cat's like a marshmallow with my toddler at that point in time. And he'd just be like a pillow on the lap of my daughter. But then, you know, you think in the back of your mind, well, I've seen him do this with the cats. Would he ever do this with the kids? So it's hard. I mean, how do you rebuild your own personal trust with your pets when you've seen them do something just so out of the normal behavior?
It's so hard. And we could talk if you'd like, and we don't have to, but we could talk about how I approach cat on cat aggression issues from when you're doing an introduction, because they're not the same in some respects as you typically see on websites. And I could address that if you want, but I'd also love to just comment back on something you said earlier, which is the idea that some cats are indoors, some are indoor outdoors, some are outdoors. And, you know, you look at that, there's that kind of debate as to whether cats should be indoors or outdoors. Well, some cats really need to be outdoors. And some cats thrive outdoors, as you obviously know. I mean, this is the thrust of your podcast. But even some indoor cats can benefit from outdoor experiences. And there are ways to give cats outdoor experiences. If you're worried about the safety of your cat or the safety of other animals, there are all sorts of different ways to customize outdoor experiences. And I will tell you that there are some cats at animal care centers of New York City, where I work, that go to sanctuaries. And there is a sanctuary, a 15-minute walk from where I live. And I have seen cats that you could not handle in the shelter. And the person who manages the sanctuary will tell me that within 24 to 48 hours of getting into this sanctuary, you could pet some of these cats. And I've seen them. I've seen it. I've pet them. And I'm like, wow. So outdoor space and expanded territories can go a long way to helping cats who are feeling that compression. I talk about how if a cat comes into a colony and they kind of go to the edge of the colony and are kind of trying to get permission to come in, the distance that they have is greater than the distance we have in any of our homes. So we're the moment we bring another cat into a home, we are compressing the space in a way that for some cats, this is just not good.
Yeah. And one thing that we really discovered in the cat rescue community during the pandemic was the beauty of using the foster homes to adopt cats out rather than depending on the shelter space and show in really so many under-socialized, or some people would call them unadoptable fosters that have been in the foster home for, you know, a year. No one's ever going to want to adopt this cat, even though the cat is perfectly fine, but not seen in the shelter. Zoom and video conferencing made it so that these cats could be shown in their own way of behaving. And you could see they're like a normal cat, and gave greater opportunity to shine in their personality. No matter how hard we try in a shelter, when I used to do adoptions, people would say, now, how is this cat going to behave when I get the cat home? And I'm like, I really don't know. You have to take a leap of faith, because I can tell you how this cat's going to behave with another 43 other cats that are here free roaming in this main room here. But I can't tell you what this cat is going to do immediately upon entry. I can tell you what the tips are, how to get the cat acclimated to the home, but this is not like buying a purple couch. There's unpredictability here. We have to have a leap of faith. This is a commitment. It's when you have a child, you don't know what their personality is going to be. I can't return my child. And that's the same thing we have to do when we're talking with folks about adopting a cat. Now, you work with a lot of shelters, and some of these cats have been tagged with behavioral issues. Are you working with the organizations to try and help facilitate successful adoptions? Or how is behavior playing a role in adoption?
So I do most of my work in terms of other shelters with the animal care centers. I consult a little bit for some rescues, and I've given presentations to different shelters in different parts of the country on various topics near and dear to our hearts. But in the shelter at ACC, I primarily work with assessing cats for behavior as we see that cat today. We can't, again, like you said, I can't say what this cat's going to be like tomorrow or in your home. So what I do is we make observations and we assign, we have our own kind of system of assigning behavior levels to cats. And those speak to the type of home, the experience level of the home that we're looking for. And so a lot of the work that I do is helping figure out how we should find good placement for the cats. We now have a new adoption center at our Manhattan location that includes, for the first time ever, a habitat. Our new Queens Adoption Center also has a couple habitats, and we also work to place cats into these habitats, which is its own sort of process. And very interesting, because one of the things that we've learned, and I think shelters who have habitats also learn this as well, is that cats tend to get along pretty well in a habitat where none of them are the owner of that space. And so it's much different than when you're bringing a cat into your home and you already have a cat there. So a lot of my work is with the cats, also working with them, the ones that are having behavior challenges. We provide socialization and enrichment and try and help them do better. We have a special program for extremely scared cats called the Frady Cat Club that works to help them improve more quickly than if we're just trying to offer treats and work that way. And then I work with clients at the shelter as well, either in surrender prevention. There's a different team for surrender prevention, but I'm sometimes called in for that reason. Or I work with adopters or foster homes to help them with a behavior challenge in the home.
Excellent.
Wouldn't it be fantastic if your whole TNR team was on the same page? Imagine your staff and volunteers mastering trapping best practices, prepping cats properly for clinic arrival, and making everyone's job easier. Would you like to give them a toolbox of tips and tricks to refer to whenever trapping gets tough? Our monthly virtual TNR workshops are perfect for group training, covering everything from TNR philosophy to planning, equipment use, public relations, because we are all going to run into those stubborn neighbors, and cat care tips, plus more. With Q&A sessions, handouts, customized content for your program, your team will be ready to successfully reduce the number of free-roaming cats in your community. Ready to turn your trappers into a team? Great! Email Stacy at communitycatspodcast.com or call 978-239-2090 for details.
Want an easy grant opportunity for your animal organization? Maddie's Fund is giving away a $3,000 grant each month to one lucky Maddie's Pet Forum member. You'll automatically be entered to win each month when you start a new discussion, reply to a new post, or upload a new library resource. Learn more at forum.maddiesfund.org today.
Are you a proud cat parent looking for the perfect, affordable health care for your kitty? Well, look no further than the Community Cat Clinic, conveniently located in Woodstock, Georgia, just north of Atlanta and not too far from the Tennessee and South Carolina borders. The health and happiness of all cats are the top priorities at this feline-only hospital. From preventative care, spay, neuter, and vaccines, to specialized and innovative treatments like full mouth dental, ultrasound, radio, iodine therapy, emergency blockage cases, they've got your cat's well-being covered. For the TNR community and local shelters, they offer easy-to-access, low-cost spay-neuter services and volume appointments. So if you want to do a large TNR project, this is the clinic you want to go to. It's worth the extra trip. Appointments are available most days. Check out the Community Cat Clinic online at communitycatclinic.com or visit them in person at the Walmart Shopping Center at the Shops of Trichem on Highway 92 at Trichem Road in Woodstock, Georgia. More purr, less price.
I would like to change topic a little bit here and find out more about your work. Tell me about this project that you were involved with in Chernobyl. Tell me a little bit about the details on that and what did you learn and see in that experience?
During Hurricane Sandy, I worked for the ASPCA's Field Investigation and Response Team, and I met a visiting vet named Dr. Jennifer Betts. And after yelling at her for screwing up our medical process, I worked in medical administration and medical treatment at the time. The next day she came in and she said, "Are you going to yell at me again?" And I was like, "Oh God, no, I'm sorry." You know, it was so loud in that temporary shelter that we had to wear hearing protection. And to have a conversation with someone who was 3 feet away from you, you'd be yelling. So yelling was just the normal level of conversation anyway. But the moment she said that to me, we both laughed and we became really good friends. And I asked her, she later became the medical director of the Dogs of Chernobyl project, which was done under the auspices of the Clean Futures Fund, which is the umbrella organization that handled this project. And I asked her if I could join the project at some point. It was started in 2017. And in 2019, she said, "Stephen, I'm ready for you." It was an invitation only at that point because there were people who pretended to be experienced in either veterinary work or animal welfare because they were what we call rad nerds, radiation nerds. They were bounty hunters. They were looking for objects in the exclusion zone or around the plant or around Pripyat, the abandoned town, and to take them home, right? These things. And they were always found out because their medical skills were zero, right? And they were sent home. So it was invitation only. And I had just started working at the animal care centers when they were getting ready to go. And I went to my new boss and I said, "Hey, you know, I couldn't make this a condition of employment, but I've been asked to go. I would sure love to go. Is there any way, while I'm still on probation, could you let me go for a few weeks to do this project of spay, neuter, and research?" And leadership said yes. And they said, "But you have to give us a presentation on it when you come home." So I took photos and video, and I've created a PowerPoint, which I then gave. And then I shelved it because I just kind of forgot about it. And then when I was doing cat behavior webinars over Zoom, I remembered the Chernobyl presentation. And I started offering it through my website to mostly to libraries who let me present it. But it was a fascinating experience. And I met people who lived in essentially their homes in the exclusion zone, essentially no electricity. I can tell you a story about someone I met there, but it was a deeply moving experience as much because of the work that we did to help the dogs and some cats, but also to meet people who live in a different way than we do. You know, if you ever want to complain that your Chinese food delivery is running late, I try and think back to the people I met who live in a radioactive forest outside the Chernobyl nuclear power plant.
Yep. Yeah. Yeah. I had the same opportunity. I was in high school. I had the opportunity to go to Papua New Guinea. And you get exposure to a whole different way of being and appreciate just the basic supplies that we get in this world and, you know, our electricity and our cell phone and our computers and all that. So with Chernobyl, you did spay neuter for the own cats and dogs in the community, as well as some free roaming dogs. Is that the way the project works?
Yeah, that's a pretty accurate way of describing it. The town of Slavutich, which is where all the workers live, they get on this old train every day. We would get on the train with them, and it was a free train. It would go one stop, you know, an hour to get to Chernobyl, and it would go through the country of Belarus to get there. And so as a service to the community, we did spay and neuter vaccinations for both owned cats and dogs in the town and community cats and dogs. There were community dogs in Slavutich, which is not, it's common in other countries, but it's not very common in the US. We have community cats, right? But not community dogs. These are dogs that live either in the community or on the fringe of the community, are cared for by the community, but don't have a home. So they live their lives, they're fed and they're cared for. So we did that. And then we would go to Chernobyl when it was time to move on to that part of the project and do daily spay neuter, as well as medical care, testing, deworming, vaccinating. We also implanted ear tags that had dosimeters in them so that we could track on successive years, we could track the cumulative amount of radiation that these dogs were absorbing. And I get all sorts of questions in the webinar about radiation effect on the dogs and does the radiation affect them and how long do they live? And the lead researcher, Dr. Tim Mousseau, who's published widely around the world now on this topic, discovered that there's strontium in the bones of the dogs. And the program brought back about 34 dogs in the second and third year. We couldn't bring anything back the first year, but the Ukrainian government gave us permission to bring puppies back, but they'd have to be quarantined for several months. They had to basically clean out their intestinal tract. It would all have to be paid for. It was very expensive, but all 34 came to homes in the US and Canada. Every single owner donated a blood sample to the National Institutes of Health, which is doing DNA sequencing and has been studying these dogs to see what their lives are like. Because in Chernobyl, unfortunately, the environment is so rough that these dogs don't live in a full lifespan. So we don't know what sort of radiation-related end-of-life conditions might occur because they don't live that long. But Dr. Mousseau also discovered that there are social groups in the exclusion zone. The dogs, one pack of dogs would be walking across a field and they would stop, they would freeze, and they wouldn't take another step because they knew that this was the boundary of another group. And the groups didn't interbreed. There's no interbreeding among the groups. And a lot of the dogs descended from these pet dogs left behind after the accident, and others were not related. So they were able to figure that out as well.
Very interesting. We'll have to get you to do a webinar on the whole thing because I find it just really fascinating in the that happened back in the 80s. So these are fifth, sixth, seventh generations down the line. So this is more than that. Yeah. You wrote a children's book. It seems a little bit interesting. You know, feline behaviorist becomes children's book author. So that's an interesting path. How did that come about?
Well, in building out my business, when I went part-time with ACC, an idea was given to me by a friend, someone who works with me as a partner in my company. And he said, wouldn't it be great to talk about cat behavior with kids? There are lots of books on cat behavior for adults. There's very little in the way of books. And I didn't want to do just a how-to, you know, problem, solution. I wanted to weave a narrative, a story about a family. And the book is called Happy Comes Home, right? It's on Barnes & Noble and Amazon, and it's in hardcover. It's also on my website. You can get a signed copy, by the way, if you buy it from my website. But it was a story about a family that wanted to adopt a cat from a shelter. And the child, his name is Avery, dreamed of all the happy things that this cat would do. And when they brought this wonderful looking cat home, who if in the first kind of drawing, and my husband did the illustrations, are all done by hand. They have a lot of life to them. You see Happy for the first time, and Happy looks really happy. But there's also, you know, this little mischievous grin going on. And in fact, when they get Happy home, it's what we called a catastrophe, right? And Happy does all these things that you wouldn't want a cat to do. And they Google cat behavior help. And this human-sized cat, who coincidentally has blue and green eyeglasses, just like mine, rings the doorbell. His name is Mr. Top Cat. And he helps the family understand why Happy is doing these things. After they find Happy disappears right when Mr. Top Cat shows up. So they have to figure out where Happy actually is. Anyway, they work through all the behavior problems so that the family feels great about this. And we made a point of not giving a gender to Avery and not giving a gender to the cat. And I found that people either don't think about it or they just make their own assumptions about gender, which we think is great. We just didn't want to push in either any direction like that. But I'll tell you, writing dialogue and writing narrative that doesn't include gender in the English language, it's really hard not to create a word salad. Even talking about it with you is a little bit tricky. Mm-hmm. But in any case, that was what the book was about. And we wanted to be able to help children connect to their pets, to their cats, and come to a compassionate understanding. And again, as we were talking a little bit about earlier, you know, my first really affecting moment with a cat was at the Joplin tornado. And relieving suffering and teaching about compassion is not something that we generally teach below a professional level. Therapists, doctors, nurses, it's just not taught. So I want to teach it. I want children to have that experience early in life of what it means or what it could mean if they're reading a book, to have that experience to prep them for compassion.
And for those of us that are out there doing trap, neuter, return, feeding community cats, we are the examples to the community about caring for animals. We are part of that humane cat community. So you are setting an example, meaning you, the listeners that are out there, are setting the example for how we should be taking care and treating of animals, as well as our neighbors and the folks that are out there for people, for the children. There was a story many years ago where a teenage girl threw a kitten down a flight of stairs in a public housing complex in a community. And a 7-year-old boy picked up that kitten and brought that kitten to the person who was out feeding the cats in the feeding station out at the public housing unit. And the feeder said, "Thank you so much for giving me this kitten. I'm going to go get the kitten some help." But she said, "Well, how did you know to come to me?" And he was like, "I know you are the person that can help the animals here. I knew I could ask you for help and I wasn't going to get into any trouble or anything like that." That boy knows that it's okay to ask for help now because of that action. And I know that is one of many frequent stories that we see on a daily basis, those of us that are out there that are under the guise of helping cats, we're helping community. So, Stephen, I want to ask you, in your world, we've touched upon it here a little bit, but to drill down, what does a humane cat community look like for you?
Well, you know, and to what you just explained, I would ask that anyone listening today who has any knowledge of someone who works in the community with cats, see them feeding, but you know they're out there, go offer some support. Tell them thank you. Let them know that you're on the vanguard and the forefront of a movement to help all the cats. So for me, a humane cat community is about compassion, about care, about support and knowledge, and understanding that there's no one solution and that it is important not to vilify any group. Everybody is working for the betterment. Everyone in animal welfare, including adopters, I sometimes say to adopters, you think we're animal welfare on one side and you're the owner, you're the pet parent on the other side, and we're kind of separate entities, but we're not. The adopter is a part of the animal welfare movement. They are the one who is learning about this cat more than we could ever learn about him or her in the shelter. And so they participate and they deserve our support. So humane community to me means we are literally all in this together. And yes, some of us might work in this area and some might work in that area, but I try so very hard. And I don't actually, it's not that I try hard to be compassionate. I feel that I have learned to be compassionate because of all the things that I have seen and the experiences that I have. I and my team go to trauma therapy just because of the things that cats that are brought to us in conditions that I don't talk about to people outside the organization. It's just too, it's not fair to them. And so I guess a kind of holistic community of compassion in a judgment-free space where we all work together.
And we create opportunity, building that toolbox of resources, being able to offer those resources. And I'm with you 100%. When I was doing adoptions at the Merrimack River Feline Rescue Society, I welcomed adopters to the family. When they adopted, they became part of the MRFRS family. And if there was ever a question or an issue or a problem or not a problem, and they just want to let us know how things are going, we're there. You know, we're there. And it is a connective situation. When someone surrenders a cat, they volunteer, they donate, they're becoming part of this MRFRS ecosystem, a family based on community. We're all sort of within a certain region. Not a lot of people came up from Florida to adopt from Massachusetts. So, you know, in general, they're sort of local, but it's a tribe. It's a tribe that we all believe in the fact that we can take care of the cats in our community. We can provide for their needs and we can provide for the needs of the community in general. And we can basically celebrate all things cat, which is what we're all about. And we're continually learning. We are so continually learning because in 1995, I didn't know what feline enrichment was. I knew what scratching the sofa was. I knew what the litter box was. But feline enrichment and cat licky pads and churu and all this other stuff, there's so many more tools and so many additional items for our toolbox, which is just great. But we're learning and always be open to learning more. Stephen, if folks are interested in finding out more in the work that you are doing, how would they find you?
The best way is to go to catbehaviorhelp.com. It's my website. I've got lots of resources on it, ways to contact me, links to webinars that I give both on Chernobyl and my cat behavior webinar, Decoding the Mysteries of Cats. I'm on social media as well, Facebook, Instagram at Cat Behavior Help. Currently on TikTok, I don't know for how long, at cat_behavior_help. But the website is the best way, catbehaviorhelp.com.
And is there anything else you'd like to share with our listeners today?
A super quick story about community. About a year ago, almost exactly a year ago, we adopted a cat to a retired couple, Marilyn and Mike. And I helped them with some issues with their cat Scamper, issues that aren't fully resolved to this day, but they love this cat and they call me every week. Every week I talk to them and I talk to them just because we want to talk. And I feel we're now a part of each other's community. I love them dearly. I never expected that I would make that community connection with a couple in that way, but I did. And that's what we do.
Yep. That is what we do. And then as you get more people calling you, you will introduce them to somebody else and they'll form a connection and they might not need you as much because we do also have to protect ourselves and ensure that our cup isn't overflowing with too many obligations. And I also do feel like a lot of folks that are out there doing trap, neuter, return, involved in this space, get overwhelmed and don't take the time to heal themselves and protect themselves. And again, it's community. So it's not just about you. It's about making a circle and having other folks create community amongst themselves. Stephen, I want to thank you so much for being a guest on the show, and I hope we'll have you on again in the future.
I would love to come back. And anytime you want a webinar on Chernobyl or cats, I'm there for you. It was a super pleasure to be here and meet you today. Thank you so very much.
That's it for this week. Please head over to Apple Podcasts and leave a review. We love to hear what you think, and a 5-star review really helps others find the show. You can also join the conversation with listeners, cat caretakers, and me on Facebook and Instagram. And don't forget to hit follow or subscribe on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, YouTube, Stitcher, or wherever you listen to podcasts so you don't miss a single show. Thanks for listening, and thank you for everything that you do to help create a safe and healthy world for cats.